Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
molecular tour of coal inter azine, and that's a lucifer, which is a molecule in bioluminescence. Now, I suppose it's always very curious to me, because bioluminescence is the production of light, cold light. It's sort of a brilliant thing that could be done. It sort of speaks of highly efficient production of light, bioluminescence. But there's just a few odd things which got me into thinking about it. There was the occasionally seeing some bioluminescent funguses while I was walking in the Australian bush, seeing it there. I think I once saw a firefly in North America, and then seeing glowworms, all very interesting. And then there was just a small section at the end of Apollo 13 where I don't know what his the astronaut's name was, but Jim Lovell, he said that he was flying and his instruments went out. There was no instruments, but he could actually follow the bioluminescence of the water back to the carrier back in the Korean War. So that was a sort of very interesting stuff. And I think a few pictures of unusual bioluminescence. So this is actually a living organism. It can be a bacteria or anything which collects molecules together and feeds that molecule, generally with oxygen or something like that, or calcium ions. It changes the environment, and it can actually switch on a light, either as a pulse or something like that. And I suppose what caught my origin is that also interest in that people said, and this I think is highly unlikely, that you'll be able to actually spot bioluminescence on another planet. You can look far enough out, and they pointed out that particularly corals don't have bioluminescence, but they have down conversion. They down convert ultraviolet light to green light to better favor photosynthesis. All very interesting. And then the amount of sea creatures which have luminescence in them, which is pretty, sort of pretty amazing thing. This is the large areas of ocean with luminescent bacteria, so our ocean are just gently glowing at night. Look, I must admit, there's been sometimes, I can't remember, I think it was a lake in Canada, which you could have sworn the ice was glowing, but that couldn't have been. It was just a pretty eerie colour. But some 76% of deep sea creatures have some form of bioluminescence, so that's more than not. And the reasons for bioluminescence are varied. In that for finding mates, warning predators, you know, glow, don't eat them, for luring prey, luring it, warning, I don't know, signals, communications. It's hard to say why all that above a bacteria would be bioluminescence, unless that colour with some sort of quorum sensing. You've got the Euglena with a light detecting light detecting cell, you know, so it will actually swim towards the light, because the Euglena is sort of one of those animals. I suppose it's called a half animal, half plant. It's beyond, outside the plant animal kingdom. It's a eukaryote, single cell, neither plant nor animal, that actually can actually photosynthesize. So not all plants are not responsible for most of the photosynthesis. It's a cyanobacteria, a basic bacteria, which is responsible for the lion's share of oxygen production on Earth. But getting back to bioluminescence, I'm going to give you a tour of a molecule, and this is just sort of, I suppose, give background to it in terms of that I'm slowly grinding forward, just making inching progress, rehabilitating, sort of storing information, forgetting it, going back again. I'm just recently going back to grinding through typing speed, and it's we're getting 35 to 40, and people, I read the comments, I can't break 50, I'm stuck on 50, and then you see the best people in the world produce 150. So that's sort of a bit of a wake-up call for you to go ahead and doing brain training. Just glacial improvement down at 65% percentile hither and yon. Just really, really killing you going across. So this overall thing is to read a section, recall the information, and sort of eased off just reading into podcasts, partly because of concerns about copyright and that type of stuff, but also to really, I want to read a section and then do a podcast on it to actually go across. So here we go to lucifins. There's a broad category of molecules that under certain conditions, generally with the addition of oxygen and release of carbon dioxide, like your standard molecule. It's a little bit different from the molecular proteins inside the body. It's not like lucifer, it's not a protein, it's a molecule. So it doesn't appear to be run by the cell machinery batteries of ATP, adenine triphosphate. ATP goes to ADP. So ATP goes to ADP to AMP. This is the phosphate. Gets removed and it loses its charge. It's a little battery which is charged and flies around. And so this is not this molecule. And you can sort of see the overall molecule. The first thing I want to say is that a large number of animals have evolved independently the ability to make various lucifins. And just having a few look at some of the molecules over there. There's some really high in calcium and magnesium, some with a few sulfurs, a few interesting molecules there. But lucifin, that's vastly evolved, doesn't have any of these unusual atoms. So usual atoms in the usual suspects of atoms is hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and occasionally for about, I think, two of the amino acids, sulfurs, you add in there. And so once you start adding other things in, it can become extremely interesting. And there is a molecule which I want to get back to, which is like the most interesting molecule of all time. This is the molecules bacteria use to split nitrogen. Okay, so this is lucifin, and it's the sort of the generic, the lucifin I'm going to describe to you is the generic molecule that a large number of marine phyla use. There's groups of families. use, and the major thing is that's common, but the actual molecules which produce the lucifer and the luciferase, sort of parent cofactors with it, vary greatly from species to species. But this molecule is a general one, and the way that I describe it will be an isomer of it. That is, you can the bonds can rechange and can reshape, I would assume, with the production of light. Now, the obviously, to produce light, you have to push electron up in one orbital, and then it has to jump down to a lower orbital and produce light. It's got to be some sort of dipole transition moment of energy. And I think red light, 1024 nanometer is one electron volt. 2 electron volts is 612 nanometers. So I have to really get that in my head to check whether that number's correct there. So to get a blue-green glow, you've got to have 3 electron volts, or getting up towards 3 electron volts of energy to get your blue-green glow. So how this actual molecule does it, this is, the molecule has to go through a change, and doing so, there's got to be an electron in an excited state for it. It's got to get the energy from exchange. So it's a pretty incredible molecule. So we're going to start off in my mind left to right, and we have to start off with something called a phenol group. So you've got benzene, which is it's actually not a yes, it is a phenol group. So benzene is C6H6. It's a flat molecule, 2 double bonds, or 3 double bonds, and on average 1.5 bonds inside a ring of 6 carbons. Now, a phenol is where you remove one of the hydrogens and add a OH. And generally, you'd say that counting down the way you count 1 carbons, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So 1's at 12 o'clock, 2, 3, 4's at 6 o'clock, at 10 o'clock there's 5, at 8 o'clock there's 5, and at 10 o'clock there's 6 going around. And in general, you put the OH at the 1 and the 2, 3, 4 at the bottom of this hexagon. So you've got the hexagon and the pointy point starting at the page. That is sort of rotated and points to our main molecule, which is a very familiar shape. Now, I just have to remember it's from amino acids, everything, and that's basically a hexagon of carbons with a pentagon of carbons next to it. And so that docks into this, and I'm going to start to describe the number of the atoms. So on the left, we've got a hexagon of carbons, and you can actually substitute a carbon with a nitrogen. It's got one less bond. A nitrogen is basically a carbon with the proton actually pushed into the carbon, if you like it. So proton's actually not out there, it's actually pushed into the nucleus to make a nitrogen. I say this because we now have got that phenol group off to the side, and it's going to link to this molecule, and we've got in this molecule the central sort of support deck for it. It's got a ring of 6, and with the pointy bit above and onto the ground, and we go around here going counting the numbers 1 to 6 going around. Now, number 1's a free carbon, number 2 is a nitrogen, another carbon going down, say, at 4 o'clock, then at 6 o'clock, another carbon, at 8 o'clock, you can hear the background, at 8 o'clock, we've got another nitrogen. Now, if it's got a nitrogen, in this case, it can't have anything bound to it. It's got a one less bond. Well, it's sort of like an internal bond, just holding its electron in there. And number 6 is another carbon. So it's 6 and on to 2 and 3. Are linked another pentagon of molecules. So you've got the 2 and the 3 of the 6 ring, and we're going to describe that 5 ring a bit later on. But going back to this, to our first 6 ring of the 6 and 5 hexagon and pentagon together, we have the phenyl group. Take a hydrogen off the 3 or the 6 o'clock one of the phenyl group, rip that off, rip a hydrogen off the that the hexagon it's going to, number 5, stick it there, and we have the first thing added to our phenyl group, and we're now going around that. So that's 5 at 1, it's just normal carbon, nitrogen, another carbon, but that's that carbon has got some work to do, linked off to a to that pentagon. And number 3 carbon, so 1, 2, 3, so 4 carbon at the bottom there, is hooked on to the following thing. It's hooked onto a carbon with 2 hydrogens on it, and then that's hooked on to a benzene group. So if you can imagine this other up the top here, and it's a bit hard to for me to imagine this in space, you've got your phenyl group, and we've counted through phenyls at 5, carbon, nitrogen, carbon, and attached to here on the bottom one, number 4, is a carbon and benzene group. So it's there. This is all, of course, just to test me. Then the next unit up at number 5. Okay, number 4, we've accounted for what's connected to number 5. 4 is the leftmost carbon in your ring from the bottom. So it's 1, let's go, 1, 2, 3, 4, sorry, I say it wrong, it's number 5 up there is a nitrogen. And then, sorry, did I say before 6? 5 actually means 6, you count through. At the top is number 1, off to the right, 2, down 3, bottom is 4. And we've said attached to that 4 is this carbon and benzene group. 5 is the nitrogen, 6 is a direct phenyl group. So there's a phenyl group. So on that phenyl group, on the first one is an OH. So I hope I've said all of this. I can picture it really well. So that's done. The first phenyl group, the internal ring of 6 with the pentagon on it, and at the hanging off the bottom is this other ring. And now we're going to start to work through. We're nearly through there. On 2 and 3 of our ring, central ring is a pentagon. So the pentagon goes, at the top of the pentagon we go one, one, and on number one we stick an oxygen, very important there. Number two, we've got a carbon, and on that carbon we we'll just keep on going in that pentagon underneath. So it's one, two, three, make that a nitrogen. Four goes into back into your ring, and five again is the number two section, is a shared nitrogen. So each of those two rings, the five, the six off to the left, and then the five off to the right, have a two nitrogens in it. The sixth ring has a nitrogen at positions two and three, four, five, opposite. Whereas in the nitrogen ring, it's got nitrogens at positions 2, 5, going up again. We've double counted that there. Hope I'm doing too well. So we're nearly there. Now on the carbon number 2, which is on the apex of your pentagon. So your pentagon has a flat side mating with the flat side of the hexagon. We have a another carbon, one carbon, which has four bonds, one to the pentagon, two to the hydrogens, and one to another phenol ring. That is a ring of carbon with an OH at the other end. So we've gone right off to the right here. I'm trying to describe it as best as possible, and it's really good for me that I'm doing this. We have a phenol group which has got six carbons. Traditionally, we call number one the one with the OH on it, and then going back to it, you have going back at number two, three, four is connected to a carbon which is connected there. Now, going over through, I don't know whether I'll try and review this. It's a fairly big, complicated molecule to describe. There's some sort of molecules, generally linear molecules, that are easier to describe. This one where you've got all these different things, groups hanging off it, it's actually quite hard to describe. So this is, and it's probably best to get Lucifer's, the Wikipedia article up on it. This one, I actually see it as you go through. I suppose the points in it is the OHs in it make it water soluble. The oxygen close to the nitrogens, the oxygen group sticking up there in the pentagon, means that you can have hydrogens move around, and it can have rebonds and reconfigured, so it can have the same molecule, can have, I suppose, different electron configurations, which is, I suppose, important for light, and also the fact that you have, basically, if you reduce the number of the number of hydrogens in it, and get double bonds, benzene molecules, you're getting something which is a bit more closer to graphite. So obviously graphite's pure carbon, no hydrogen. So if a hydrocarbon's got heaps, or what's that, hydrocarbon? Yeah, no, not hydrocarbon. I've got to think of what the methane, ethane, propane, butane, pentane, hexane, septane, octane, nonane, decane. Oh, I don't know. Goes on. What those are called? They're not hydrocarbons. with 100 car baits. I think they are called hydrocarbons. Yeah, so the less hydrogen you have in it, the more carbon, the more metallic it is. That is, the molecules, the oxygen, what you can say, the more of a carbon crystal it goes. Even though it's organic, it starts to move into a more crystal phase, and your electrons are dissociated and form planes. And the more hydrogens you remove, and the more closely dense, the more rigid the structure is. So overall, this is a very interesting molecule, and it's hard to actually, you can sort of half close your eyes and half imagine how it could respond to light. It's chemical induction. It's a pretty amazing molecule in that you structure it and it's sort of, you fold it in one direction, bonds fold in one direction, and it's, the electrons move out and produce light. It's almost as though it's I can imagine. Now, the issue is electron in quantum physics is not a point, it's a large amorphous spongy shape, and you can sort of imagine, for me at least, this molecule taking an electron, pushing it, bending it, pushing it up, and then radiating light. And I could well imagine that it's interesting that the molecule doesn't store light. It actually relaxes energetically by the production of light. So in terms of, and also production of light requires a dipole transition moment. So how that goes is a very fascinating thing. But it's obviously something that has given animals that produce it a clear evolutionary advantage, and one wonders how much what that evolutionary advantage is. What on earth could be the given that, say, bacteria, jellyfish, all these things are very ancient things, and I think vision occurred, vision, sex, and the explosion of life happened 550 million years ago. With no eyes, I think bioluminescence, the incredible thing is that bioluminescence probably came into existence when there was no eyes for it. Why would a fungus, why would anything produce light if it wasn't going to produce it, if it's not going to if there's no eye light detection to see it, I'd just be interesting to know at what point bioluminescence came along. Was it there for a long time? And the idea of large amounts of bacteria, what would be the advantage for bacteria glowing? Because the individual bacteria is basically too small to be eaten. As far as I know, animals scoop up plankton. They don't. There's no animal that just eats bacteria. So I just find it a very unusual and interesting thing. I think we really don't understand the origin of it. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll continue working on this. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things
understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.